even remember off the top of my head the amount, but just like massive amounts of money spent to intercept all of those missiles. And really just, I think the economic cost to Israel was quite high. But it was also kind of showing the deterrence factor as well. And I think you could see, like, with all just the behind the scenes negotiating, will Israel strike Iran? What will the US allow? What will the US not allow? Just trying to like help Israel save face, but also avert any kind of major escalation. But I would say, so with all of this happening, though, I mean, at one point, I think everyone was making reference to World War III is about to, has just initiated. But I think it was just like, I mean, I think it was also like a big distraction, if I could be honest. And really, it was just taking away attention of what's happening, on the ground in Gaza. And though I did see in some reports that Israel would have already launched an invasion of Rafah had it not been for the Iranian retaliation. And so I'm not sure, and I don't know, what will happen in Rafah or how that will escalate, because they are already, there are Israeli bombardments in Rafah at the moment. But yeah, I mean, I think it's just also important to keep the attention back on, like, let's not get distracted by all of this political theater. And I'm sure Rami also has a lot to say as well.
No, I agree with your assessment, Hiba. One part that bothered me, not what you said, what I saw in the media, was the United States government insisting that Iran launched an unprecedented attack on Israel. Unprecedented. If any sovereign nation had their embassy bombed with people who work for the embassy killed, I mean, imagine if somebody bombed the British embassy in New York City. Just imagine what that would look like and what that response would look like, both from Britain and from the United States. So here we have Iran, which, whether I know Americans are brainwashed and Iran bad guy. Yes, so sure, you got it. You cannot bomb an embassy. That is a war crime. Any country would respond at a minimum in the way that Iran did, if not much, much, much more. So the fact that, like Hiba said, not one person was killed by Iran's retaliatory strikes shows that maybe we've been misled our whole lives over who is the bad guy and who is the good guy. So, most Americans have an unfavorable opinion of Iran. Name five countries Iran has attacked. Name five countries Iran has bombed. Name five countries Iran has occupied. I challenge you to do so. Now, let's do so for the United States. How quickly can we come up with those five countries? How quickly can we come up with 50 countries that have been attacked and occupied by the United States? But somehow we are the good guys and Iran is bad. That is silly. We should be serious thinkers. We shouldn't fall into propaganda and brainwashing, and we should think critically and objectively. You will ask the average American, the only thing they know about Iran. I don't even know if they could name anything they know about Iran. I know, neoliberals were up in arms about Iran's treatment of women, and they don't care about Iran's treatment of women. They were upset about that for 2 weeks, and then they never mentioned it again. So all of this political theater revolving Iran is insincere. And like Hiba said, it serves as a distraction from Israel's heinous war crimes in Gaza. And now we're talking, oh, should Israel strike back? When's Israel going to strike? This is silly. It's political theater. This was a brief blip, a quick moment in time. You bombed an embassy. You killed folks who work in the embassy. We're going to attack military targets. You cannot kill our people who work in an embassy. You cannot bomb an embassy. If Iran did not strike back, it would be a sign to Israel to continue bullying and pressuring Iran, which, by the way, Israel has done many things to antagonize Iran, including funding extremist terrorist groups within Iran. You know, just a few months ago, ISIS, don't get me started, bombed a funeral in Iran and killed 40 people. So convenient that ISIS seems to only target Islamic countries, to only target countries and folks who are enemies of the United States of America. ISIS will never attack Israel, but ISIS will make sure to fight in Syria, to blow up funerals in Iran. Truly, truly, truly convenient. And I urge everyone listening to dig in, do some research about ISIS, who funds it, when it was created, and who benefits from actions of ISIS. But don't get, I don't want this show to be taken off the air for you to get arrested, Samuel. You're a good guy, so I want you to be safe.
Thank you, Randy. I hear the sirens. No. Yeah.
I wanted to say something, Sam. Listening to Rami speak, I was thinking about the unprecedented attack that he was talking about, and what came to mind, I get this picture of American government continuously saying that individual other countries, they're like these rogue countries because they support terrorism based off of whatever crimes or deaths was there. So I believe you're right. Even if there wasn't a political stronghold there, if somebody, like you said, if somebody attacked an embassy from Great Britain or another one, and America comes to their aid, or somebody from another country or people from this country in America, they find out that these countries are being funded or helped, I don't see how it should automatically be in our minds that, well, Egypt, Syria, Iran, Iraq, these are all Muslim countries. These are all ethnically similar people. So why are we not saying that as a whole when America's funding individual countries, groups, and then they become rogue? And because as we know, even Osama bin Laden was once funded by the United States and was trained by the United States. So it's more than a double standard. It's more than a double standard. And I just believe as a whole, civilians need to pay more attention rather than trying to be wise and just think inside the box. Forget outside the box. America funds anybody they want. But everybody in America always goes with the media outlook that, oh, America said they're bad, so they're bad. And if we consider all of these countries bad, they're not allowed to help or fund each other or come to the aid as allies. But America, if they say it's an ally, it doesn't matter how many they kill, as you see in Israel, how many children and women die. You see what I'm saying? That's what I was thinking about, Rami, as you were speaking. And it's a terrible sight. And it gets depressing to me sometimes. It really does. To the point of tears, man. I just think, like, why doesn't anybody see this? And I just believe personally they see it, but the comfortability that America can provide a majority of people keeps us in a state of not wanting to see, not wanting to hear, not wanting to know, because it's not beneficial to us. You remember the African Americans when they were fighting in the 60s, in the 70s, the leaders were killed. You know what I mean? And this is what they call Willie Lynch syndrome. They've embedded so much fear, not just in the African-Americans against Caucasians and Europeans, but also the world against each other. And even though we know, I think it's like, hold on, I don't have nothing to do with it. And they'll say anything that coincides with it being all right, okay. I don't believe in our hearts I don't care what anybody said, that they can actually believe it's right. Because if I run in your home or you run in mine and we start killing kids, there's no excuse for that. There's no righteous excuse for that. You can make an excuse based off your perception of life, but if you have no perception of somebody's life, if I dishonor your life and your life is meaningless to me, Rami, then of course, somebody killing you is okay with me and I can make any excuse. And anybody with the same mindset is also going to agree with it. You know what I mean? And it's just painful to see, bro.
You're absolutely right. And one thing that America has done very well is to dehumanize Arab people through media, through movies, through the images that you see portrayed of Arab people. Years ago, I used to challenge my friends. This was maybe 5-10 years ago. I used to say, I want you to give me an example of a positive Arab, character in a movie, in a TV show, anything. Think about not an oil tycoon, you know, buying sex workers or, you know, doing like buying Lamborghinis, not a Dubai rich, you know, like, I don't want to curse. So like, you know, not the typical stereotypical Arab, either super wealthy or super barbaric and violent and vile. No, you always saw caricatures. And that's the only example of Arab people a lot of Americans are familiar with. You know, somebody in South Dakota has never met a Palestinian, but they've seen 20 movies in which Arabs are always depicted as violent terrorists or greedy oil barons. And so we're not human. And what really sealed the deal is the word terrorist, because once you give somebody that label of terrorist, you dehumanize them. That's why it was so important for the Zionists and most of American media to declare the military offensive on October 7th as a terrorist attack. Because if you think military offensive, you think a trained group of people, whether they're a militia, an army, whatever it is, with a plan and trying to enact that plan. When you think terrorism, you just think a bunch of violent dudes running around just killing whoever they see. And when that's what you're fed and that's what you're led to believe, you don't have any sympathy for these people. Not only do you not have sympathy, you're not going to analyze that. You're not going to learn their history. Every Palestinian resistance group has a very clear history that can be studied, that can be researched, and then you could decide, do you agree with them or not? But most Americans are just going to hear the word terrorist. That's it. Oh, they're terrorists. Yeah, they're killing babies. They're sexually assaulting women. They're chopping off body parts. They made up all these disgusting stories to push the narrative that these people are terrorists and that these terrorists all came from Gaza and Gaza supports these terrorists. And therefore, anybody killed in Gaza, it's essentially like you're killing a terrorist. And when you see the Israeli WhatsApp groups, when they react to images and videos of Palestinian children dying, babies, you can see the comments. And I'm not talking anecdotal one or two. I'm talking thousands upon thousands of comments. Good. One baby terrorist gone. It won't grow up to, you know, be a terrorist. Or good. This girl is dead at 10 years old. She won't grow up to have Palestinian terrorist children. And no matter who dies, they find a way to excuse it because it's either a terrorist or a future terrorist or somebody who will breed terrorists, right? So this racist word of terrorist, which only seems to apply to brown people, has further dehumanized Arabs and caused Americans to have a lack of interest in terms of studying and analysis and objective thinking. So yeah, you're right. In one of the Rambo movies at the beginning, it said this movie is dedicated to the brave Mujahideen who were fighting the Russians. Who were these brave Mujahideen? They were the Taliban. After 2001, these brave Mujahideen glorified in the Rambo movie with Sylvester Stallone, you know, Mr. America firing his machine gun everywhere. 20 years later, they're not the brave Mujahideen anymore. They are enemy number one. Our freedom depends on them all being dead. What happened in 20 years? You know, that's a different story.
Good point. Very good point. You know, Sam, hear this too, Sam. And, you know, when you look at the history, I don't like to consider myself African-American, you know, or African at all. The original name is Al-Kibalon. But the people, the brown people over here, African-American, I can see as time goes on with the Palestinian-Israeli war, as far as taking a history of African-Americans also, you see the brainwashing. And I believe that when something happens, it's usually the same. It's the same power structure. You know, it's the same power structure. The American government, the UK, or whatever it is that have this United thing, United Nations thing going on. It's the same entities that have basically enslaved, caused apartheid and separation between African American and everybody else. And I see the damage. I feel the damage. I'm a product of the damage of that separation from the world, the same way that it's being done to the Palestinians, the Muslim community as a whole, as well as anybody else. They'll alienate and cause this mental dysfunction, and it caused my people to actually implode on one another and become so fearful of the world. And when I walk around, whether I'm taking a bus, a cab, I go into a store, and I understand it now, whether it's Hispanics or Palestinians or anybody over here, they have this healthy fear. But I'm pretty sure now, I'm 48 years old, I turned on the 17th, I'm pretty sure now, people, if they really pay attention, they'll understand and see the dynamic between the people that continuously, no matter what people have a stake in society, how to cause a dysfunction with them, cause the world to look at them like bugs on a wall, like animals, like terrorists, like you said, you know, and all they have to do is utilize these names that have been programmed in our minds. And I was once one of them people. I was never the super hard racist, but I was very uneducated until I really started to delve into it. So I looked at people not the same also, you know what I mean? However, I never wanted to demonize and destroy or ethnically cleanse a people, you know what I mean? And that's what's going on. Geno Jennings, if you ever heard of him, and if you haven't, look him up. Geno, G-I-N-O, Jennings, J-E-N-N-I-N-G-S. Geno Jennings, he's a pastor. And he's one of the best in the world. And he was talking about, I seen it today, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And he was talking about it. And he gives so much insight on it. And he was talking about all people are the same. And he went to scripture and he talked about
seems like we've lost Devon for a moment here. Devon, try disconnecting and reconnecting if it doesn't patch you back through. Okay. There was a thought I had while I was talking about the way there's sometimes like a struggle within. I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts on the conduct of the Palestinian Authority during all of this. Are you guys there?
Yeah, it kind of froze for a second, Samuel.
Sorry.
I missed the last few words you said. My apologies.
So as Devon was talking about how there can be sometimes division in movements and between people. I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts on the conduct of the Palestinian Authority in all of this that's been going on.
Hey, but please go for it.
So I mean, I can just share, I mean, and this is like what I observed when I lived there. So I had mentioned that the first time I went to Palestine was in 2006, but then I did return in 2008, and I lived there from 2008 through the end of 2011, you know, and just being there. I mean, you know, the Palestinian Authority, it very similar to how Rami was speaking earlier about how the, you know, Arab governments are complicit and, you know, they're like the puppets of the U.S. I mean, I would say the same goes for the Palestinian Authority. They're very much complicit, you know, with both the U.S. and Israel. I mean, they, through the Oslo peace process, the sham peace process that it was, you know, they became, I guess you could say, like co-opted, where they are, you know, they cooperate on security arrangements with the Israeli government. They always have been, and they are now, you know, trying to clamp down on any kind of protest among the people. You know, when they're protesting for Gaza, protesting against, you know, the Palestinian Authority, against Israel, the PA, security forces are the first ones out there trying to repress that. And, you know, they're really lining their pockets. They, you know, with all the aid coming in, as long as they do what they're told and they kind of go along, you know, and I don't know how they can sit at the, you know, back when there were negotiations, how they could sit at the negotiating table when I feel like they're, you know, they're not really representing the best interests of the Palestinian people and really kind of, you know, fighting for what it is that the Palestinians are fighting for their self-determination, for the right of return. And I think they're just so easily co-opted. And as long as they go along and they play nice, you know, they get a lot of aid and it only makes them more wealthy. And they just kind of go along with it. I mean, that's my observation from just, you know, the time that I was living there and even just, you know, following now. I mean, and you know, what I've always kind of heard in just like discussing with, you know, with Palestinians, it's, you know, just this feeling that they're not the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. They're illegitimate, but also irrelevant. I mean, I feel like right now, with everything happening, they don't feel like they're even relevant to the process or to any kind of outcome. So yeah, that's just, you know, my own observation.
You know, I agree with you, Hiba. It's really a shame, especially when we've seen the past week or so with armed settlers terrorizing folks in the West Bank. And the Palestinian Authority, which is well armed and well funded, thanks to their cooperation and them basically being a puppet group under the influence of Israel, couldn't even go and posture in a way that would show that we are ready to defend these innocent Palestinian farmers and families who are being shot, whose cars are being burned, whose homes are being attacked and vandalized. That's in the West Bank. That's where the Palestinian Authority has power, right? And even then, they won't go and protect their own people. So Hiba's right. They're irrelevant. Not only that, they're useless to the Palestinian people. What good are you if you have these security forces who seem to only target Palestinian resistance fighters? We don't see the Palestinian Authority defend Palestinians. We see them go after those who are defending Palestinians. That's the great irony. The only people the Palestinian Authority will fire at will be Palestinian resistance fighters. So that shows you how truly despicable they are. And, you know, you as a Palestinian, I feel more disappointed in them, of course, than I do with the IOF soldier. The IOF soldier is brainwashed thinking he's on the right side of history. What is the Palestinian Authority employee's excuse? The one who points his gun at a Palestinian freedom fighter, who fires his gun at a Palestinian freedom fighter? How can they live with themselves? They are truly Israel wants the Palestinian Authority to be in charge of Gaza, because then it's just, okay, we have our little puppet here. They're going to do our bidding. we never have to worry about any sort of resistance. So it's, the Oslo Accords were truly a shameful part of Palestinian history. Those who once fought for our liberation sold us out, and we're paying the price. We've been paying the price ever since, unfortunately.
With the Oslo Accords, that was the PLO, right? Under Arafat? That,
yes. Yes. So after the Oslo Accords, the PLO agreed to lay down its arms and stop fighting against the state of Israel. And that's when, if there was a resistance operation, the PLO would actually arrest the resistance fighter. And so the PLO basically shifted into the Palestinian Authority. It's no longer the Liberation Organization. Now it's just the Palestinian Authority. Now they're the Palestinian police who are there to arrest resistance fighters and those who conspire to harm the state of Israel. So they are another arm of the Israeli police, so to speak. That's their effectiveness. That's the actual tangible thing that they do, is arrest resistance fighters. They have Palestinian Authority jails where they have hold resistance fighters and those who aid and shelter resistance fighters. It's truly sickening, especially coming from a man, an organization that did fight for Palestinian liberation at a point. But who knows? I mean, money and power and pressure can weaken and destroy a lot of people's integrity. And, you know, my personal opinion about Arafat is he tarnished his legacy forever by selling out his people and by agreeing to the Oslo Accords. And Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the PA now, is his hand-picked successor. He's like, I want this guy to be, you know, to replace me. And he's been even worse. So it's truly shameful. Palestinians, nobody sees Abbas as like the president of Palestine. No one sees him as a leader. He's a joke. He's literally the butt of jokes when it comes to Palestinian conversations you'll hear in Palestinian homes. Only the most brainwashed, bootlicking Palestinian will have any sort of support for the PA or Mahmoud Abbas. This is anecdotal, but personally, I've never met a Palestinian who supports the Palestinian Authority or Mahmoud Abbas. Never in my life have I met one. I know they exist. I argue with them online, but I've never met them in person.
Now, is Fatah related to the PA, or is it a separate?
Fatah was the biggest group in the PLO. The PLO was compromised of, or was compromised of several Palestinian factions. So, for example, at one point, the PFLP, which are, you know, the communists, Palestinian resistance group, the Fatah, who else was in? There were several Palestinian groups, and they made up the PLO. Fatah was the biggest part of the PLO, the biggest slice of the pie. So they were the biggest Palestinian resistance group at one point. So yeah, the PLO is made up of several groups. After the Oslo Accords, groups like the PFLP left because they're like, what the hell is this? We don't agree with this. So many groups left. So the PLO was basically just Fatah, which became the Palestinian Authority. An interesting thing is that Fatah, just like how the Islamic Resistance Movement in Palestine, Hamas, has an armed wing, which is Al-Qassam Brigades, Fatah had an armed wing called Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades. After the Oslo Accords, they were ordered, hey, you know, we're all done fighting. Lay down your arms, please. Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade said no. And so they continue to exist until this day, completely separate from the Palestinian Authority, from Fatah. So it's kind of interesting how that worked out, how they still exist. It would be the equivalent of Hamas, you know, signing some sort of agreement deal with the Zionists, but Al-Qassam Brigades being like, well, you, the political side, you guys can do that, but we're going to continue to fight. So that is the case with Fatah, which did order its military branch to surrender, and Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades does not. In fact, they are currently fighting the Zionist forces in Gaza and have been for since, you know, early October.
Yeah, that was something I was always a little confused about, because I was reading about Fatah and reading about the PLO and reading about Hamas, and how with the Oslo Accords kind of just created the climate for Hamas to come into power and to, because they were the only major group that continued to resist with arms of consequence. So then, like, as you were saying, because the PLO laid down, or the non-armed wing decided to cease that resistance.
It's strange because Hamas in the late 80s started off as like an Islamic group that was involved in charitable activities. They had mosques, they had universities. They were not a militia by any means. This was, as you said, a response to increased Israeli aggression. And because of the Oslo Accords, because of there's no one now fighting, taking up arms for Palestine. And to show folks what the two-state solution would look like, it would look like what the West Bank is today. A castrated, unarmed Palestinian populace hoping that the Zionists decide not to kill them that day. That's what the two-state solution would look like, because Israel would never allow Palestine to have an independent army. It would never allow Palestine to have, you know, a true independent government. What would prevent Israel from creating settlements, from, you know, attacking Palestine on day two after the peace treaty is signed? So West Bank is what this two-state solution would look like. West Bank's supposed to be, you know, independent and run by the PA, but no, it's occupied Palestine. It's still militarily occupied, still checkpoints. There's still, you know, it's still run. It's still essentially a part of the settler colony known as Israel. So there is no peaceful coexistence with a Zionist entity, just as there would be no peaceful coexistence with Nazis and Jewish people in post-World War II Germany, right? So it's kind of ludicrous what is being asked of Palestinians, to share their stolen homes with those who have been committing a genocide against them for nearly 100 years. So a little bit of a tangent, but that's the thought that popped into my head based on the discussion we're having.
I get very angry when I hear U.S. politicians still talking about a two-state solution, as if, you know, even like in the wake of like the genocide that's occurring, but as if it's even like a feasible proposal. Because if you look at the West Bank, and even now, even since October, illegal settlement activity is continuing and accelerating. Continuous land grabs made by Israel. And you know, even in the West Bank, there isn't fully contiguous land to even create a state. And even if Israel were to agree to dismantle some of the settlements and the wall, there are still some areas that they absolutely refuse, you know, to give up. And so it would be like these vast areas where settlements have really like really taken over large portions of the West Bank, that, you know, Israel will want to like redraw borders around that. And that's going well away from the Green Line. And when I was there and just seeing it all in person, it really became clear that this, you know, this idea of two states, it's just not, you know, it's incredibly disingenuous when you see American, you know, politicians, the president, congressmen, speak of it, other Western leaders speak of it as if it's even like something that's viable. Because when you see the landscape, it's like you can't even fathom how it could even work. And also, as Rami was saying, you know, Israel's like refusal to allow Palestinians to have their own, you know, their own standing army, have full control over their airspace, have full control of the borders. You know, there's currently military buffer zones along the you know, the border with Jordan, and that's also something that Israel has, you know, will not want to fully give up. So it's not there will not be there will not be a two-state solution that's actually a just solution for the Palestinians, and it's absolutely impossible, and I just don't see that ever happening.
I completely agree with you on that. That the continued discussion of a two-state solution by our politicians is nothing more than attempting to, put everything on a slant towards something that is not ever achievable. Especially given the state of things with the settlements and the vast amount of infrastructure that has been built to exclude Palestinian villages and enclaves within their own lands, to try and box them in, make it unlivable, to such an extent that people can't access, as you were talking before, on the olive, their lands to harvest their olives. They can't access them. They can't herd their sheep. They can't access their water. And then you also have the destruction of water infrastructure by the settlers and the IDF. You have the destruction of cisterns. You have the tearing up of irrigation infrastructure. And the monopolization of water by the occupiers, which would make, as with the situation in Gaza, it would cause the Palestinian state to have to completely rely on the Israeli state for things like water and power, and it would be a situation much like we've seen in Gaza, where it's not true independence if they control everything going in and out and have a say over during conflicts or unrest how many calories people can eat a day. Just sick levels of control that they have. Sorry, getting a little upset thinking about all this. So we have 23 minutes left, 22 minutes. Is there anything that you guys would like to discuss that we have not yet covered?
Hiba, is there anything you'd like to discuss or, talk about? I'm totally open.
So I guess one thing that's kind of on my mind, being in New Jersey, and before joining this program, I listened in a little bit on a call launching the Uncommitted campaign for New Jersey, and we're moving into our primary election day, which is on June 4th in New Jersey, and so it was Uncommitted was not already on the New Jersey ballot, and it was a very fast but effective mobilization to get the required signatures to ensure that that option was included on the ballot. And after securing that victory, there's been additional challenges because the way in which it appears on the ballot, was counties had, it was almost hidden where it was placed on the ballot, the size of the font, and the way it should appear is, you would have an option to select uncommitted delegate, and underneath it, part of what was fought for with getting that on the ballot was including the slogan "Justice for Palestine, Ceasefire Now." But in the mock-ups, it was so small that you could barely even detect that there was an uncommitted option. You couldn't really see it. You couldn't find it. So there have been challenges to that, and I think that that has largely been corrected, though I think there's variations among the counties. But those mail-in, the mail ballots are going out like imminently. They should be going out around now. Those who are, who have signed up from, to receive or opted to receive the mail-in ballots should be receiving them soon. And I think it's really important that we mobilize. I mean, I feel like, and for me, like personally, like I feel like the New Jersey primary comes so late that it always feels like it's kind of meaningless because, you don't really feel like you have the chance to kind of, add your say to like who's going to, win the nomination, I would say like in a regular kind of presidential election year. Because usually you already have the numerics of it all. You have your candidate. You know who the nominee is by the time New Jersey has the chance to vote. But this year, I think it's really critical because we know that, President Biden has the Democratic nominee for the upcoming election. But it's our chance to really voice our anger and the fact that we do not support his policies and that we do not want to vote for him. And I think just following the campaigns in Michigan and Wisconsin, which have been, quite historic. And, New Jersey has also one of the largest Palestinian communities in the United States. And so I think we feel like it's really important for us to really make our voices heard through this campaign and having that option. And to tell, to tell the president that, you've crossed a red line and we do not support you. We cannot support you. So yeah, I mean, I think it's something interesting to watch. And I would say, don't count us out. It's one of the last primary states to vote. But I do, yeah, I mean, and I think I do see how, with the results coming out of some of these swing states, I do think it's having, along with everything else and the mass protests, I do think it's having an impact. I think that I still think the Democrats don't really care. They obviously don't really care about the Palestinians. And I think that they are maybe surprised that Americans care as much as they do and have been showing that. And so I don't think there's been a major transformation, but I do think that these things all kind of incrementally help to, maybe move policy just ever so slightly in directions that are more positive. But yeah, and I don't know what it was like in your respective states. I know New York had a good showing. For I guess there was no uncommitted option, but it was the leaving the ballot blank. The numbers were unlike they were ever seen before for that option and elsewhere. And Rami, I'm sorry, I don't know where you're based, but I don't know if you've had your primary yet and what that looked like.
So I'm in the Chicago area. And, Chicago and Illinois is largely a Democratic voting area. And we have seen in Chicago so many protests. And I think the folks that I organize and I'm in community with have completely lost faith in American electoral politics altogether. And honestly, that's where I am. I don't participate in electoral politics at this point. I did vote when I was young for Barack Obama, who turned out to be one of the tokens that I had mentioned previously. And so I, along with my community, have focused our efforts on local politics and things that we feel we can help actually create some tangible changes in our environment. But before 2020, I was telling anyone who would listen that Joe Biden has been on record for decades saying that he's a Zionist. So as a Palestinian, one, I'm not voting for him so that 100 years from now, my great grandkids can be like, Why did great grandfather Rami vote for Joe Biden when he said he was a Zionist? How could a Palestinian support a Zionist? It would be like a Jewish person in Germany voting for Hitler to go into power. So I wasn't going to have that on my conscience. And two, I believe every country gets the leader it deserves. I believe when we had Donald Trump, that was exactly who this country deserved. And if we do vote in leaders who lead to the toppling and the fall and the dismantling of this country, then so be it. Because it's not fair to ask Palestinians to watch their people die in Gaza and then also martyr themselves for the Democratic Party. No, absolutely not. I have no loyalty to the Democratic Party. They have misled people like me our whole lives into us thinking that they are allies and they care about people of color. The Democratic Party is a warmongering, violent, racist, imperialist force that has caused pain and turmoil in every part of the world. Barack Obama deported more people than George Bush Jr. He was bombing seven Muslim countries simultaneously. And this was something that was hard for me to accept as a young man. You know, my first time being able to vote was for Barack Obama. And I was so excited. I couldn't believe somebody with the name middle of Hussein was about to become the president of the U.S. I was literally, my friends and I drove around Chicago honking our horn, thinking like, we won, we did it. What a fool I was. By the way, Barack Obama used to be in close community with Palestinian organizers in Chicago. So he knows the ins and outs of the Palestinian liberation story. He would even argue with people and he would know the finer points of pro-Palestinian arguments. I know from people who have worked with him and met with him. And then when he's president, all of a sudden he has this elementary understanding of Israel and Palestine as if he is, you know, any other leader. This was a man who was friends. I've seen pictures of him with dinners with the man who runs Electronic Intifada, which is a very, you know, revolutionary, liberatory media outlet. He knew Barack Obama personally and said that Obama was very well educated on Palestine. He knew the nuances. He knew the arguments. And then he's president and all of a sudden he doesn't know anything. And, oh, I just want peace and we'll continue giving money to Israel. So I'm just so disillusioned with electoral politics in America. I'm so sick of being told to vote for the lesser of two evils and to push them left. And to, I've heard this every single election that I've ever, that's ever happened in my adult life. I know insert name here is horrible, but we have to vote them in and push them to the left. And it's just nonstop, nonstop. And when is this push to the left going to happen? I haven't seen it. I've seen our Democratic leaders go more and more towards the right. And I just feel like there's no place for me in American electoral politics, maybe because it was never designed for me in the first place.
Wow, Remy, very powerful what you just said. And, you know, I was surprised to learn that about Obama, that he was so close with Palestinian organizers, because wasn't he the one who signed the $3.8 billion a year aid package for the next decade? Yes. So to then do that after being elected into office. Tyron, do you wish to? Oh, okay. It's just mind-boggling. honestly, I'm also completely disillusioned with the Democrats. I'd never even considered the Republicans. I'm going to vote for Cornel West, because that seems like the only person I can vote for and have a clean conscience about it. But it's... yeah, electoral politics in this country, unless we can, in the next 4 years, create a third party that is on par with the other two, that can beat them in the next election, I think, like, we're just, until we can break this two-party system, until we can create a more dynamic political system, it's definitely not built for all the people. Never was.
You know, and what I've noticed with, for example, I live in a village called Oak Park, about 10 minutes west of downtown Chicago, very liberal, progressive area. And a friend of mine who was in local politics in a different city about 25 minutes away sent me a text saying, hey, look, your village, Oak Park, there's some people who are trying to organize a ceasefire vote in your city hall or in your village hall. I was so excited. I couldn't click it fast enough. I'm like, finally, okay, I'm going to be a part of it. And I see the first part of their speech is, we officially condemn the atrocious attacks of October 7th and the kidnapping. So they had to make sure that it led with that. And when I expressed my frustration with the person who sent me the text, they said, oh, well, it'll never pass if it doesn't include that. So what it led me to think is, as Palestinians, we're always forced to make these little concessions. And the more, so let's say I make that concession, then let's say, you know, you run for alderman, you make more concessions. Then by the time you get to Rashida Tlaib's position, where yes, you're the first Palestinian congressperson, and it sounds amazing, how many concessions have been made to get to that point? And at some point you lose yourself. You lose what you were fighting for originally. How can I, as a Palestinian, sign something that condemns my people for fighting back? I can't attach my name to it. And we feel this pressure to pacify ourselves in order to make our thoughts and our opinions and our feelings palatable for white people. And no, I'm not going to be a part of this. You know, my whole family doesn't live in exile from Palestine. My grandmother and grandfather didn't die in exile for me to make concessions, to make white people more comfortable with me so that I could shake hands and maybe one day be a mayor, or maybe I'm just not going to do it. And I understand, I know everyone's not going to think like me. I don't try to convince others to think like me. I'm merely explaining and expressing why I feel the way I do. I feel like a true revolution must happen in this country. I don't feel like liberation will be achieved through voting, through electoral politics. It just doesn't make sense to me. And it's like how you see in Israel, right, in occupied Palestine, there's Palestinians in the Israeli parliament. And all the only good thing we've got out of that is Israel using that against us. Oh, we're not an apartheid state. We have Palestinians in the parliament, in the Knesset. So how can we be an apartheid state? That's the Palestinian politicians' effectiveness, to be used against us to show how liberal and welcoming and loving Israel is. And I fear that that will be what the Ilhan Omars and the Rashida Tlaibs will be for America. So we're not racist. We're not Islamophobic. Look at these two token congresspeople we have. You know, Rashida Tlaib has done things like vote to put sanctions on Syria, basically siding with the U.S. and Israel. If you have the same position as the U.S. and Israel on anything, you're probably on the wrong side of history. And these are my fears when we continue to prop up and push for liberal leaders. Again, going back to my rant about tokenism and tokens, is that we'll just be used by white supremacists to absolve them of their sins, to absolve them of their guilt, and to make their conscience feel a little bit better. And I cannot play a part in that. If there was a way where I thought I can contribute and do more, I would. So my efforts go towards community organizing, direct action, and I wish the very best to anyone in the uphill battle of trying to seek liberation and freedom for Palestinians through a purposely racist, imperialist, colonial system that the United States has. It's quite the uphill battle. I'm not strong enough for it. Hiba and better people than me can participate in that battle. I just simply can't do it.
Oh, and I agree with you, Rami. I mean, I feel like I'm very disillusioned. And I feel like in the past, I used to go along with the, you know, I feel like as a Palestinian American, you never feel represented when you look at a ballot. But then you you make those compromises. So I feel like in the past, I've went along with, you know, who is the lesser of the two evils. go with that option because, putting like foreign policy aside, go with the candidate that's going to have the better, domestic social agenda. But, after so many election cycles, I think I'm a bit older than you. I'm a Gen Xer. Just feeling like really disillusioned and just really angry. When Obama was, when he was elected, I was actually living in Palestine. So I did not, was not organized enough to do an absentee vote. So I actually sat that one out. But having been living there at the time and for a while before, like I was already like, just not really, just not having the same perspective as all the folks, here in the U.S., that excitement that they were having about him. And I just feel like, I will say, like, at least I feel like when we get our ballots in the mail, like in the next week or so, just having that uncommitted option to me feels meaningful only because it's like the first time there's an option that you can actually feel like represents you. But as far as like, what happens in November, I've been voting third party for a while now, and we'll continue to do that. I don't think that's going to be, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, that's not going to bring about any kind of change. It's more like symbolic. It's more about like having a clear conscience, not giving up that right to vote, but doing what you can with it so that at least you feel like you can sleep better at night. But I agree. I mean, the whole system has to be kind of torn down and built back up. We need a multi-party system. That's the only way.
I completely agree with that as well. There needs to be a complete revitalization. By revolution or whatever means we can use to completely overhaul this system. We have a little less than 2 minutes left. So if you guys want to give some quick outros, then I'll lead us out with a song.
Let me say something.
Oh, okay. We've got...
The lady saying that she's voted for years and all of that. But, voting, doesn't that help continue this system, continue this oppressive system? You're there. In other words, then you giving a vote, to me, it looks like you're also in supporting it indirectly. You're supporting the actions that you're against. At least, you know what I'm saying? But indirectly, I understand, you know what I mean? But the fact that you're voting for it, because here it is, the system is fixed in a way where they want to tell you have a choice. But we really don't have a choice, do we? You know what I mean? And from the comments that I've seen the two of you give, the Republican Party, the Democrats, they have a lot in common. They both have their hands out to the corporate structure. Who is running things? They're running things, And those same two parties have prevented other parties. They have an agreement among themselves where other parties outside of them cannot come in to the main, on the main platform, They've actually have an agreement. So what I'm saying is you're voting for these Democrats, you're voting for these Republicans. I mean, what is it? To me, it's more like supporting the apparatus. You're keeping it going, Because in my opinion, yes, it should be brought down and it should be changed completely. And those two parties should be gone. Because to me, it's just one party or two parties with one name. What is that? That's it. They're doing the same thing. So that's what I'm asking. You know what I mean? I believe, there should be something radical.
Finish.
That should go. But yes, we got to go. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm taking up a little too much of Matt's time here.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I'm just, that's just my opinion.
Thank you. That's Tyrone, by the way. another DJ here. Unfortunately, we have to end. But if